Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease.
Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. Today, I want to introduce you to Tamar Fenton. She deserves all of our love and support as she tells the story of her daughter, Liel, and the way this mitochondrial disease ravaged her life. In fact, this disease ravaged through her family's life, as it often does, and we all know that. While this story may be tough to hear, it's beyond important. The work Tamar has done since Liel's death is incredible and will make everyone in this mitochondrial world give a little cheer. Tamar, thank you so much for being with us today and for sharing your story on Energy in Action. Welcome.
Thank you for welcoming me. I'm really pleased to be here and to be talking to you today.
Well, we are very lucky to hear the story and for us to learn everything about Liel and about, you know, the work that you've done since her passing. So let's start by just hearing about your daughter. Teach us who she was and the fight that she fought.
That's my favorite thing to do because I obviously don't always just want to be talking about her medical odyssey and her death.
There's so much more.
So much more. And her life, though it was short, 21 years, was incredible. What she was able to accomplish, how many people she was able to touch. And of course, that's still going on even after her death. But just to talk about her, she was like tiny. She was 4'11" and she would be upset if I didn't mention Anna Half because she put out three times on her bucket list that she wanted to reach 5 feet. Didn't happen except for if she stretched really hard. But so she was tiny, but mighty. And I called her Sister Golden Hair Surprise. That was one of our favorite songs together, but also her hair was this like unreal color of strawberry blonde that would look really red in some settings and really blonde in others. And it was just glorious, curly, beautiful. She was spunky, tenacious, super opinionated, strong-willed, funny and wise beyond her years. I wrote down a lot of the things that she said in her last years, and I just have a few of them. She said, "They should give me a punch card for every embarrassing medical procedure I've had to endure." She said, "Mommy, you really have to work on being in two places at one time." And really a profound one was, "Learn your worth, be a hotel, not a motel." These were just some of the things. And before she got sick, she was always in perpetual motion. She kickboxed. She had written a book to demystify mental health for children. I used to accompany her to slam poetry competitions where she was the only teenager. It was all adults and her sharing her poetry, spoken word. She learned ASL, sign language, to become a big sister to a deaf child in the Big Sister program. And at one point, she even went undercover for an organization called Tobacco Free Alliance Minnesota, where she would go and be a minor, she was a minor, and try to buy cigarettes or vaping stuff. And if they sold it to her without asking for her ID, a police officer would then come in and cite them. So she got herself involved in a million different things. And one of the really incredible things that she did also, even if she was sick, was she developed a TikTok following and a live stream following of 400,000 people who were following her, you know, funny anecdotes about life, but also about her medical journey. And I know that she touched so many people, especially through her live stream, because it was a lot of younger teens that would listen to her. And I would walk by and hear her telling them, "If I can get through this, you can get through it. If I can do it, you can do it." And even I heard her giving out the suicide hotline number to kids who were really struggling, who were looking to her for help, and she would direct them back to a trusted adult and where to go with that. So that's just some of the things. She was beloved by us, by her brothers, by lots of people, and just a very special, smart, courageous girl.
You mentioned her brothers. How many brothers does Liel have?
She has three older brothers. She was the little sister to all of them. very close to them, all in different ways. And there was 10 years between the oldest and Liel, and even they were able to bridge that gap and have a lot of fun together. And she was close to all of them in different ways. They loved her very much.
I'm sure. We'll talk a little bit more about her brothers as we go. You know, as we've spoken prior to today, Tamar, I think that her life in college is so unique and how she persevered and what she wanted out of it. I would love to spend a couple minutes really talking about that for our listeners.
Absolutely. Even prior to going to college, she started to have some pretty dramatic symptoms. It started with a shoulder tick, and then 6 weeks later, she was vomiting everything she ate. She was diagnosed with gastroparesis and wasn't feeling well. She had lost a lot of weight already. And I asked her, "Are you sure you still want to go to college?" And she said, "Absolutely, I will not miss this." At that time, we had no idea where this was going to lead because we didn't know what it was. But she decided to go to college, even with physical issues, and throw herself into it. She was a public health major and loved studying it. And as the semester went on, she would call me with additional symptoms, brain fog. Her pupils were permanently dilated. She couldn't control her temperature. She actually, the first night she was on campus, had 3 seizures. And I returned really quickly to New York where she was in school. And they ruled out epilepsy. And this was sort of the start of, oh, it must just be mental health, or it must be, you know, you're stressed about being in college, or someone spiked your drink kind of thing. And we already had a GI for her in New York. And then we got a neurologist in New York. So she was seeing doctors there. We were flying her home every 2 months to see doctors here. And she just kept pushing through. She did great in her classes. Her professors loved her, but we were getting worried because every time we came home, she would be diagnosed with something else like POTS, or she'd have to go to the hospital with dehydration. And then they'd discover that she had tachycardia and prolonged QT. So all of these things were happening. And then COVID hit. So she had to move home. And shortly after that, she started passing out dozens of times a day. I mean, the most we counted was 100, but she couldn't walk anywhere unattended because she would just be talking and then drop to the ground, lose all muscle tone and have a seizure. So for her safety, we would either, if we were in the house, we would walk her from place to place, which for a young woman who really had started to express her independence was really a lot to deal with, that she had to be chaperoned everywhere. And then outside, she had to go in a wheelchair because being on the pavement, if she crashed, it could cause so much additional harm. So she was in a wheelchair and she was still attending classes by Zoom. And because she was passing out so much, she asked us to strap her into her chair so that when she passed out during her Zoom classes, she would be caught before her head hit the desk. And that's how dedicated she was to her studies. Her professors understood this. I mean, they were let in on what was going on. And so when all of the other students went back the next semester and they eliminated Zoom learning altogether, 100%, we went to the university and said, listen, she can't come back. And the only way she'll be able to continue is if you allow her to Zoom. And it went from her department all the way up to the dean, and they made accommodations for her. So during the rest of her years in college, often strapped into the chair, sometimes in the hospital, and even when she was on hospice, she would not miss her classes. And her professors also worked independently with her so that when she could no longer write papers, she could orally tell them what she had learned so that they could continue grading her as if she was just a regular student. She developed really deep relationships with a few of her professors because of this, because of working independently with them. And for her graduation, since she obviously couldn't attend in person, her entire department planned a graduation for her. They sent her a cap and gown and her diploma, and they did a Zoom graduation for her where they spoke about her resiliency and her how much she had inspired them, and how she, they just couldn't believe her wit and her intellect. And I just want to find it and read it to you, what the dean of her department said at her graduation ceremony. He said, "I have worked with thousands of students and been to many graduations, and yours will stand out by far as the most rewarding. Hofstra is now a better institution because we had the privilege of having you as a student." So that was her college experience. She was already on hospice, had been for many months by that time. She dressed in her cap and gown, and we watched it, as did 100 other people remotely. Lots of tears, of course, but we were so proud of her. When she went on hospice, she set as her goals to make it to graduation and to make it to her 21st birthday. And thankfully, she met both of those goals. They were so important. We're so, so grateful to Hofstra for enabling her to do that. It got her up in the morning, on the worst of mornings, because she had to be in class.
I give her so much credit and your family so much credit for creating this person that wanted to persevere and that wanted to beat the odds. And that, you know, I could see a lot of students who are passing out so frequently just throw in the towel. And she did anything but. And I hope you are just as proud of her today as you were on that graduation day, because that's incredible. And what the dean said, it's really hard not to get emotional talking about this, you know?
Two of her professors still reach out to me very often and check in and tell me that they were teaching a class that day and thought of Liel or talked about Liel to their students about what she had done and how much she cared about public health and wanted to change the system. We just recently, we created a scholarship in the public health department using some of Liel's money that she had earned through the years in what we called her side hustles. She had many of them. And also donations that people made, because we wanted to make sure that other students could have that incredible experience and go through the public health department the way she did. And we just heard from the two first recipients of the scholarship, beautiful thank yous from them about reading Liel's story and how much it motivated them and touched them and made them want to work even harder at changing the health system so that it would benefit everyone.
Oh, Tamar, you are continuing to keep her light bright, you know, and I just give you so much credit as a mother, and I'm hoping that we can now kind of take a couple steps backward and talk about Liel's childhood and when you started noticing some issues medically and how you were treated in the medical system.
That's a huge part of this story. When she was three, she was getting a lot of strep and ear infections and other kinds of infections, and they couldn't clear them. And so she was diagnosed with an IgG and IgA deficiency, so immune disorders. And she was put on 2.5 years of prophylactic antibiotics in these 21-day cycles. They never stopped. They just kept putting her on these antibiotics, hoping that somehow she would outgrow this immune disorder. During that time, we were never told what those antibiotics were doing to her system, how to mitigate the damage that they were causing her gut health or anything like that. And when her tests on one particular day showed that her immune disorder wasn't so bad, they just stopped the antibiotics and sent us on our way. Shortly after that, we noticed that she had horrible constipation and that she was episodically vomiting. I kept taking her to GIs. I took her to her pediatrician. What's going on? Could this have anything to do with all of those antibiotics? Why is this happening? And they always just said, oh, it's just a one-off. It's not a big deal. But as years went on, other things were happening, and she was diagnosed with as hypothyroid, and her hair was falling out, and it was just doctor after doctor. And when she was, and gynecological issues that were very unusual. And when she was 13, she started having very strange mental health issues. And so we were taking her to psychiatrists and psychologists and trying to get her diagnosed. And they said it didn't fit in any particular diagnosis, but the closest thing they could tell, they could link it to, was perhaps bipolar disorder. But they were never quite sure about that. And they said, in fact, they never diagnosed someone who's 13 years of age with bipolar disorder, but they just didn't know what else to do. So they started putting her on more medications for that. During that time, she also had a test that discovered that she had malabsorption and metabolization issues. So this whole cacophony of problems were starting to mount. And I was always asking, are these things linked together? And could they have anything to do with the antibiotics? And what is going on with her body that different systems are breaking down? But through the rest of high school, Liel just dealt with whatever physically was going on and really focused on her mental health. And the year, her junior year, she was already very mentally healthy. Her psychiatrist and her psychologist said they doubted the diagnosis, that she was doing so well. They took her off of medication. And she was, you know, applying for colleges and got into every college she applied to. And then she started her college career. So this whole mental health episode is really, it was horrible. It really was horrible. It was horrible for her. It was horrible for us. But in retrospect, it feels like it was all part of this same trajectory of things happening in her body, that in which her cellular communication was not working. And it was just attacking different pieces of her randomly. So we started, when all of this was happening and during the beginning of college, and certainly when she came home from college at COVID, I was taking her to specialists. I took her to a medical center that's known for diagnosing very rare situations. And they looked back at her chart and her history, and all they focused on was the mental health piece. And so even though she was losing consciousness in front of them, she was in a wheelchair, her heart was, you know, erratic, all of these, she had all of these diagnoses, POTS by that point also, even diagnosed at that institution, they sent us to psychiatry. And that psychiatrist, after an hour, said, all of this is psychological, in her control. She has conversion disorder and psychogenic non-epileptic seizures. And we said, well, what? It didn't even sound realistic that all that your body could change lab results and could cause all of these different things. And I said, has anyone ever come to you presenting like Liel and you've called it conversion disorder? Have you ever heard of conversion disorder acting like this? And she said, no, I really haven't seen it like that, but that's what this is. Her mental health history sort of points us in that direction. And so I said, okay, what do we do about it? And she said, she should go to CBT therapy. I said, that's all you're recommending? Therapy? She's already in therapy. She's already done CBT. Well, obviously she didn't learn it. So she needs to go back for therapy. Her therapist and her psychiatrist were saying, that's absurd. This is not psychological at all. Her mental health is stellar, especially given everything going on. But that psychiatrist putting that in the chart started a diagnostic momentum, which from which that institution and no other institutions afterwards seemed to be able to diverge. And I want to say one other thing. That psychiatrist sent us to what they called their spells clinic for people who pass out a lot. And when we got there, first of all, they evaluated her and said, oh, she's passing out too much for us to help her. And I said, how is that possible? You can't pass out too much for a spells clinic to help you. They said, well, she'd be too much of a risk for us. So that was shocking. And then they had the audacity to say to me, you are enabling her poor mental health by allowing her to be in a wheelchair. You need to let her fall as many times as it takes for her brain to retrain. I mean, if you could see me right now, like my jaw dropped open. I said, are you a mother? Like how, what? You want me to let my child fall? You've seen how she falls. Like she could kill herself. She could fall downstairs. She could get a concussion. She could break a bone. And they said, well, this is psychological. So that's what you need to do. Of course, that was advice we didn't take. And we just kept seeking, help from other people. But everywhere we went, because this esteemed institution had said it was mental health, that was always the starting point. And as more things were happening and she was getting more diagnoses, Hashimoto's, polycystic ovarian syndrome, then she started getting something called tetany, in which parts of her body would just freeze up, like they became paralyzed, and her hands would, we would watch them, they would just claw And the muscles were so rigid that you couldn't move them. You couldn't pry them open. It was happening in her hands and her legs, and then sometimes her whole body for hours at a time. And I kept rushing her to the hospital, and they just kept saying, oh, this is in her control. And meanwhile, because she had the gastroparesis, she was still vomiting. She couldn't keep anything down, and she was dropping weight like crazy. She probably by this point had dropped nearly 30 pounds. And they still were said they were calling it, well, that's an eating disorder. And she would say, you have no idea how desperate I am to eat. This is not that. And they wouldn't listen. And part of it was, you know, she was young and she was female. But I was there too. And I was shocked that even I couldn't get them to pay attention and to give us a diagnosis or send us to someone who could. So this went on for at least 18 months where no one would even consider that it was anything else. And then they started to say, oh, well, this is something we've never seen before. We don't know what it is. And then finally, we couldn't take it anymore. We went to a private clinic and paid tens of thousands of dollars. Through this entire journey, we ended up borrowing about $100,000 to try to find out what was wrong and get a treatment plan for her. And at the private clinic, they finally did cellular testing. No one had even suggested that before. And oh, I need to back up, because Liel wanted to be the part of her team. And during this whole time, she went on every one of her EMRs. There were 8 of them where her records were held, and culled all of the information from every lab over a 7-year period and put together a 28-page spreadsheet that showed every lab and the cycle of what had happened on this date with the same lab result. And the pages were filled with high range, low range, never in range. And so she took that document. She took pictures of her weight loss and her tetany, her hands frozen, and rashes and swelling and all of her symptoms. And she took pictures of those. She added the results of the test that showed the malabsorption and metabolization issues. She also provided a timeline of the illness and a list of every diagnosis and symptom by their specialty area. She put it in a folder. And as we were going to all of these doctors, she would hand them the folder and say, here's information about what has been happening. Can we go over it together? And they would say, oh, no, no time for that. We'll put it in your file. So she was handing them a diagnostic goldmine, and they completely brushed it off. They also treated her horribly through this whole thing as a non-compliant teenager, as someone seeking attention, someone who wasn't deserving of this kind of attention because clearly it was a mental health disorder. And I was accused multiple times of having Munchausen's by proxy because I just kept taking her to doctors trying to get answers. So emotionally, in addition to physically, this was breaking her. It was breaking us. We couldn't believe it, even when she provided them the information. This information, anyone who understands mitochondrial disease would have looked at the information and immediately thought, oh, we know what this is, or we know what to test for, but they never looked. So it took going to that private clinic for them to do the testing, and it came back and they said, oh my gosh, her mitochondria are like shot. They have no energy. No wonder her system is malfunctioning in all of these different ways. We then did genetic testing, and Liel didn't match any known mitochondrial disease. So we said, well, what does that mean? And they said, either it hasn't been discovered yet, or she acquired it. And so then we started delving into how can you acquire a mitochondrial disease? No one is talking about it. And discovered that a certain antibiotic, in particular, Cipro, is now being studied because it is known to cause mitochondrial damage. Now, did all of those antibiotics when she was young cause the mitochondrial disease? Did it create the environment in which it could come in through other ways? We know that her body would absorb things in ways and not be able to excrete them and not be able to absorb the right things and vomit them up. So something was going on with the cells. But even armed with that information, when we went back to the medical center and said, can she be seen in the mitochondrial clinic? We were told no, because it didn't match a genetic disorder. A doctor said this, told us that, not a doctor she was seeing, but he looked at everything and said, this is exactly like MNGIE, which is a genetic mitochondrial disorder. It's like anyone who knows that disorder would look at this and say 100% that's what it is. So he found the number one expert in the world in that particular disorder and sent the records to him. And he said he couldn't see her because her genetic testing did not match the disease.
So her symptoms were matching this disease, and it was clear her mitochondria were shot.
Yes.
But she still didn't fit the hole for the peg.
Exactly right. And so we had nowhere to go, no one to help us. And it was at that point that finally, and she by this time was on feeding tubes and TPN and everything to try to help her regain weight and nourish her system and nourish her cells. And she was down to about 80 pounds and still nothing. So in that, she had all of these complications from the feeding tubes. And in her last hospitalization, she just asked, am I going to die from this? And what, you know, should I go on hospice? And that was the only time that they actually brought doctors together, that last hospitalization, to see what, you know, if there was anything to do. And they came back and said, we don't know what to do. So unless you can find a specialist, me, to help her, yes, she's going to die.
As if you hadn't tried to find a specialist at that point.
Exactly.
As if this was point one.
Right. For almost 3 years at this point, I had been trying and begging and researching everything I could do, using every contact I had, and couldn't get anyone to help us or see her or diagnose her or anything. And so she went on hospice because there really wasn't anything left. Now, what I want to say is, had someone told us early on, this is what she has, it's a mitochondrial disease, it most likely will end her life at some point, it's progressing very quickly, we would have made very different decisions about those years. We would not have subjected her to these horrible operations and to tube feeding, which was incredibly painful for her. She was in pain all the time. She was in an acute state of malnutrition. She was vomiting everything. So we would have just made different decisions. We would have contacted Make-A-Wish and said, please get her backstage at a Taylor Swift concert. That's what she wants, you know, or Liel and I would have taken the trip to Australia that she wanted. So it robbed us. I mean, it really, not knowing, not having anyone try to help us, robbed us of an otherwise much better final years for her. So she went on hospice, and that was her last 7 months. And like I said, she was studying from her hospice bed, and we were trying to make the most of those months. And we did in any way we could. I do want to mention one other thing. When she came home from college, and even though all of these things were happening, because I was literally frantic and because I was daily saying, okay, I found another doctor, we're going to go see this one, we're going to go see that one. And she understood way before I did, Mom, they're just not going to help us. I don't want to keep going to doctors. I was driving her crazy. I mean, there's, you know, I was just a frantic mother trying to save my daughter. And so she said, Mom, I need to live somewhere else. Can I go live with Auntie Dora? And Auntie Dora is what at that point was a 98-year-old Holocaust survivor who was legally blind and mostly deaf, but completely independently living on her own. They had a very deep relationship from the time Liel was a little girl, and Liel had maintained that relationship all through high school and had written her college essay about her friendship with Dora, the Holocaust survivor. And so I said, well, Liel, I'm really scared to not have eyes on you all the time. And she said, I need you not to have eyes on me all the time. I have to try to be a teenager as best I can. I will call you anytime there's a problem. So she did go to live with Dora. It was really the most beautiful thing that could have happened for both of them. They supported each other. They loved each other. They helped each other in many, many ways. But there was a lot of times during that period where she was living at Dora's where we had to rush over there and take her to the hospital or where she had to recuperate at our house. But when she was feeling up to it, that's where she was. And it was about 5 minutes from our house. So it was completely doable. I would bring over the groceries. I was shopping for both of them at that point. And so that was one of the ways we tried to make Liel's life as normal as possible. One of the hardest days was the day when Liel came back from the hospital and she was going on hospice the next day. And her brother, Ronan, took her over to tell Dora that this was the end. And if you can imagine a Holocaust survivor saying to her, no, you can't die before me. I mean, she was 98. You can't die before me. You're going to come back. I'm keeping the room ready for you because we're going to be roommates again. You'll get through this. And of course, she didn't. The next time Dora saw her was Leo had just gone into a coma in her bed. And Dora, who could, you know, barely walk, my three boys helped her up the stairs because Dora said, I can't let her go without seeing her. They basically, you know, almost carried Dora up the stairs and Dora threw herself on Liel's emaciated body, begging her to speak to her, telling her, I survived the Holocaust. You'll survive this. But of course, she wasn't going to. And yeah, so that was just another piece of this story of that beautiful friendship and trying to let Liel make decisions and be as independent as she possibly could during those years, giving her autonomy when we could.
I think the relationship that you allowed to develop in that way, it added such uniqueness to her life, to her too short life, but it gave her more experience. You know, you couldn't give her this experience or that experience, or she didn't grow old for this experience. But I mean, that's an experience that I wish I had, you know, to be able to get the wisdom from someone that has gone through all of what she endured. You know, they were both lucky to have one another. And Dora shouldn't have been lonely either. You know, she had gone through so much, she didn't need to be alone. And Liel provided that for her. I mean, it's so touching. Please write a book about that. Please.
I have written an article about it that was published. And I don't know if it's a whole book. But yes, actually, Dora had dictated in her last year. She just recently died. And I, of course, kept up the relationship and visited her almost weekly after Liel died. We would cry together and laugh together. And Dora had been dictating a book about her life to someone for the past few years. And there is a chapter on Liel in her book. So should that ever be published, it will be there. But the other thing that it did was it gave Liel someone else to focus on and think about, rather than just have to think about what was going on in her life and you know, how bad she was feeling and what her future was.
In a very sad way, it is very, very beautiful.
I agree. And Dora's family also agrees. It was the best thing that could have happened for both of them.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for sharing all of that with us. I know that it is not easy. Now, since Liel passed away, you've been doing a lot of changing the world work, we'll call it. Please tell us about that.
Yes. Liel asked me actually to promise to try to make sure that no one else would suffer the way she did, not only physically, but emotionally by being discounted over and over and being told it was mental health.
The emotional trauma had to have been just as debilitating as all of the physical ailments, you know?
She said it was worse. She said that was absolutely worse than all of the pain that she was experiencing and all of the near-death experiences that she had to come back from. So she did ask me to promise to try to do something. And she said, just tell the whole story. Someone has to listen to this. So I started by writing to all of her doctors and to the medical institutions to say, I want you to know what happened. It's not in your chart. The things that aren't there, how she was treated, things that you said that I took note of, tests that you didn't order, what she really died of, as you were saying that it was mental health. And I knew that I wasn't going to hear back from the doctors. I mean, I hoped against hope, but I knew that the medical institutions actually would have to do a review. And the reviews that they did, I mean, if they really did them, I got a short note back saying, we're sorry for your loss. We didn't do anything wrong. And we won't meet with you. I had asked to meet with them simply so that I could help them plug the holes, understand the holes and plug the holes. They wouldn't meet with me.
And Tamara, I think it's very clear because we talked about Liel's college life during COVID, but you know, it's not like Liel passed away 20 years ago. I mean, this just happened.
Yes, 18 months ago when she died. So that was just a bust. Like, I wasn't going to get anywhere. And I thought, I have got to partner with an organization that's going to help me get Liel's story out and make some change. And I found an organization called the Patient Revolution, which is working to change our industrialized medical system to be kind and careful and provide the time necessary to diagnose and treat and have empathy and not burden patients with having to find their own doctors. And so I was really interested in what they were doing. And I called them and said, this is what I've got to offer, Liel's story. Like, you know, I don't have money. I don't have this or that. I can give you Liel's story. I can tell you what happened and what I want to do with it. And immediately they said, this story is the exact reason why we are doing what we're doing. We're going to figure out how to get it out there. And shortly after that, I was contacted by PBS NewsHour because they were going to do a story on the Patient Revolution. They had been wanting to do one, but they couldn't find the emotional hook for the story. And Liel was that hook. I mean, Liel made it so that people would want to watch an expose on what the Patient Revolution is doing. So that is available. I think millions of people actually have watched it, and I heard from other people through LinkedIn, and you know, people found me afterwards to say this was my exact experience. Thank you for speaking to it. Thank you for the work you're doing. I want to get involved too. Moms who were struggling with the exact same thing in the same moments that I was. And so from there, I also recorded videos for a course called Foundations Care for the Patient Revolution, and doctors and other medical providers and advocates take this course and they learn how to become advocates themselves within the medical system or change the medical system they're working in. And from there, a doctor who had taken the course, who is the director of medicine at a prominent Boston hospital, contacted me and said, not only had it changed the way she practices medicine, she stops before she goes in to see her patients and thinks, I have to let everything else go because my patient is all that matters. She also changed the way her department handles patients, and she's going to be the dean of a new medical school opening up next fall, and they are interweaving Liel's story into the curriculum of the medical school to help medical students kind of know that this, how easily this can happen, and to guard against it and to fight the system on it so that it doesn't happen with their patients. So those are some of the things I've done. I've also been speaking at conferences, and I'm actually doing a presentation at an antibiotic stewardship conference coming up, because I can't say with certainty that it's the antibiotics that caused the problem, but there's enough anecdotal evidence and enough other cases out there. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of people talking about this through their own experiences, that, and research being done particularly on Cipro that has shown a link to mitochondrial damage, that I'm trying to get the word out. Like, don't take Cipro. that doctors are going to try to give it to you. And every woman who's ever had a UTI, that's what they're going to give you. And don't take it, because even if it's only a small percentage of people who are going to have the worst possible side effects from that particular antibiotic, you don't want to be in that percentage. And I'm pro-antibiotic, I'm pro-vaccine, they're life-saving, there's no question about it. But doctors know that that particular antibiotic is a problem and they're still prescribing it. So yes, some public speaking. And I've gotten a lot of opportunities to talk about the piece about careful and kind care. I do want people to know that the average amount of time a doctor spends listening to a patient before that doctor decides what is wrong and decides on a treatment plan and a diagnosis is 11 seconds. So if you've got a broken arm, and this is a study, a national study that was done. It's been in many, you know, prominent journals and Newsweek and you name it. So this is real. 11 seconds is the average. So if you come in with a broken arm, it's very easy to diagnose that in 11 seconds. If you come in with a complex chronic disease or set of symptoms, 11 seconds is going to get you, well, let me tell you about my heart, right? But specialists only look at one piece of the puzzle and they don't look at the totality of an illness, which is what Leo was trying to present them with. And they wouldn't. They only looked at it piecemeal and no doctors were talking to each other. So I want to not only deal with the broken system and the problems with our hurried medical system, but also talk about acquired mitochondrial disease, because even in the mitochondrial community, it's not being talked about to the degree that I believe it should. Up until now, it's really been about genetically linked mitochondrial diseases. And with environmental factors and medications and so forth, now we know that they can cause damage. I think we just have to start talking about it more. There is a toxicologist from the University of Minnesota who actually speaks in mitochondrial conferences about it, trying to raise the alarm at how easy it is to damage your mitochondria. I don't think most people would ever have it damaged like Liel's, but that it is being damaged. And his name is Dr. Kendall Wallace, and his presentation is online. And it's just important for people to know that this can happen.
I think this topic is really going to strike a chord with many of our listeners. Unfortunately, it is scary to think about how hurried our medical experiences are and the lack of coordination. I've seen it firsthand. I saw it with my mother, and I hear about it, you know, in other stories. But when it's such a rare and complex case, you know, you needed answers sooner. And what you're doing right now and what you've been doing since Liel passed away is exactly what she wanted you to do. And it's something that will make her so proud of you. And I know you are so proud of her. And it goes both ways. I know that for a fact. So how can our listeners get involved in the patient revolution if it has struck a chord with them? You know, how can they take a stand with you?
Thank you for asking that. I think it's as simple as going to their website, patientrevolution.org, signing up for the Foundations of Care course. There's a lot of things that the organization is doing. They're trying to train boards of medical institutions to start talking about care, not just the bottom line. But the thing that you can do to learn more about how to be an advocate for yourself and for others and understand really what's happening in the medical system, that Foundations of Care course is important, and other work that they're doing, you can get involved. They need speakers, they need advocates, and so forth. So that's absolutely one way to start your journey of advocacy for the issue.
Okay, great. Thank you. And we'll have all of Tamar's videos from PBS and from other areas that she's spoken at. That will all be found in the show notes of this episode. How are her brothers doing now? I mean, the loss of a sibling, the loss of a child, the loss of anyone in your immediate family is tragic and it's heartbreaking, especially when, you know, she was younger than them too. How are they doing? And how are they involved in this as well?
They're not involved in this. And I think that's probably good for their own journey through this. I mean, grief is forever. I heard someone say, when asked, you know, when are you going to be over it? And the person answered, when my loved one isn't dead anymore. So so I really resonated with that. Grief is forever. I mean, it becomes more manageable at times and it hits you at times when you don't expect it, of course. But for them, really what I want is for their journey to be their own and to get the support that they need. My two oldest boys are married and have careers, and the support that they're getting is really invaluable from their spouses and also from other means, their friends and so forth. So I think they're doing okay, but it hits. We'll be in discussion, you know, about whatever, and it hits hard. I have one son who's an editor in films. And I asked him to edit something I had done. And he said, don't ever ask me to edit something about Liel again. I can't hear all of the details again. It's too much. So it comes out in that way. And her brother, Ronan, who was the closest in age, and they were just incredibly, incredibly close. Ronan, in fact, moved home to be with her in her last years, rather that he opted to work remotely when he could have gotten a different job because he wanted to be with her during that time. So he is doing okay, but I know it hits him regularly. He calls to tell me he's been on a hike and he thought of something he wanted to share with Liel or something, or a funny video that he saw that he would have sent to her. So yeah, they're all on their own journeys, and we're on a journey as a family, and we're strong, and we know Liel wants us to be strong, and we're all trying to keep her alive in our own ways. She's always present, for sure, in everything.
I think you're doing the best job you could possibly be doing. I feel like my life is enriched because I've seen a small snapshot of who she is. She still is who she is, you know? And I encourage everyone to watch the videos that are posted. She is so lucky to have such a supportive family, and she knows that you are doing the best job possible. So, you know, if our listeners want to get involved, there'll be great opportunities to do so from links that we'll post in the show notes, and obviously just, you know, Googling around as everyone does. Tamar, thank you for sharing with us. I know that this is not easy to do, to kind of go back to some of these feelings and experiences, but it creates growth and it creates resilience for other families and great information for people that really need it. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I am so fortunate that we have connected, and I hope that we can continue to do so.
I hope so too. And thank you for letting me share my precious, wonderful daughter with all of you.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I'm so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.